9 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, who will return from vacation on Monday. This hour, the topic of discussion is the Bush Doctrine, first outlined by President Bush in a June 2002 speech, and then formalized in a document titled The National Security Strategy of the United States of America. It's a departure from previous foreign policy strategies. It places greater emphasis on military preemption, increased military strength, unilateral action, and a commitment to extending democracy, liberty, and security to all regions. Our guest this morning has written a book about the Bush Doctrine, and it's a book titled In Defense of the Bush Doctrine, and he is our guest, Robert G. Kaufman, professor of public policy at Pepperdine University. He is former Bradley Scholar and current adjunct scholar at the Heritage Foundation. And as we said, he is the author of In Defense of the Bush Doctrine, published by University Press of Kentucky, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I had to give a capsulized view of what you write in your book as an introduction. Was I fairly accurate in terms of describing what the Bush Doctrine contains?
Well, I'd probably amend a few things.
First, amend away.
First, there are two aspects of the Bush Doctrine. One is that in this new environment with the convergence of weapons of mass destruction and radicalism, it's necessary sometimes to use force preemptively sooner rather than later. That is not the norm of American foreign policy, but President Bush is right to include that in his repertoire of options. The second component of the Bush Doctrine isn't new at all. It is that in wartime, we have, since Woodrow Wilson, identified the regime type of our adversaries as the root cause of aggression. Accordingly, we have, as a war aim, committed ourselves to democratic regime change. That was true in World War II. That was true in the Cold War. That was true in this war. In that respect, the Bush Doctrine is not new. It's tried and true because one of the few theories in international relations for which there is robust confirmation is the democratic peace argument. Stable liberal democracies don't fight, so if you don't want to fight a nation again, democratic regime change is the best way to make sure that you don't have to do that.
One thing I neglected to do at the top of the broadcast, and I want to make sure I do that now because I want to invite our listeners to participate in the discussion. The phone number is toll-free anywhere you can hear this broadcast, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number. In Madison, please use the local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. If you'd like to send us an email, our email address is talk@wpr.org. And our guest, as I mentioned this hour, is Professor Robert Kaufman, a professor of public policy at Pepperdine University and author of the book In Defense of the Bush Doctrine. After 9/11, after the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York and on the Pentagon, the first reaction of our government was to go after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and to attack the Taliban forces there who were, we believed, to be sheltering him. And this had solid support both at home and abroad. Around the world, people recognized the need to go after Osama bin Laden and felt that we were justified in doing this. What changed the situation, suddenly we were at war with Iraq, and the search for bin Laden was seemed to be ultimately abandoned and stripped of resources so that we could go and get rid of Saddam Hussein. There are some who would say that there was sort of a disconnect at this point, and we kind of lost our way. But you're saying that attacking Iraq and getting rid of Saddam Hussein was the right thing to do.
Yes, and I wouldn't characterize what we've done exactly in that way. In fact, one of the things that we had to do after 9/11 is keep pressure on comprehensively everywhere. And as for the claim that we lost our way with bin Laden I don't agree with that. One of the pieces of evidence that suggests otherwise is it could happen while we're speaking, but if you had predicted after 9/11 that there would not be an attack on the United States for the next 6 years, people would have said that was wildly optimistic. There are many reasons for that, but one of which is the comprehensive pressure that the Bush administration has put on al-Qaeda, which has kept bin Laden largely on the run. As for including Iraq in this theater, that also has historical precedent. On December 7, 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and Franklin Roosevelt, rightly despite that, identified Germany rather than the immediate threat of Japan as the priority for our war effort. I think President Bush is in that tradition and right to suggest that Iraq, under the circumstances of 9/11, was one of the primary threats that had to be addressed. It wasn't the only threat, but it was a necessary threat to address. He was right. For all the heartbreak and problems, we would have been much worse off if we had allowed Saddam to stand. Let's also remember that it wasn't President Bush, but President Clinton in 1998, through his surrogate Al Gore, who first claimed that A, Saddam was going to get these weapons, and B, there had to be regime change. So the idea that Iraq represented this type of threat didn't begin at 9/11. It didn't begin with the Bush administration. President Bush had the courage to act according to these convictions rather than leave a dangerous gap between American rhetoric and American actions.
Let me give the phone numbers again, and we've got some open phone lines for people to join us this morning. 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number anywhere you can hear the sound of this broadcast. In Madison, we'd prefer that you use 263-1890, 263-1890. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we're starting to get some callers who are interested in joining our discussion this morning. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Dave in Wanakee. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. One of the problems I see with propounding Bush doctrine is that the law of universality, in which that what's good for one should be good for all, I don't see how that could work if every country had the option of, of attacking another because it thought they might attack them. Then Iran would, could attack us because they could justifiably claim that we are a growing threat to them and they should be allowed to attack us. So I was wondering how it works with the law of universality and what's good for one is good for all. Or do you grant us a self-exception as usual?
No, I don't. And, Carla, that's a very good question. And if the Bush Doctrine were stated in the broad terms that you rendered it, you're right that it does create a problem of setting a dangerous precedent and the necessity to make reasonable distinctions. Nevertheless, I make 2 points in response. One, there are cases in history where using force sooner rather than later, not waiting for the threat to metastasize, has been morally and geopolitically correct. One of them, of course, was the 1930s, where had we heeded Winston Churchill's advice at various watersheds, we would have stopped the most dangerous threat in history that resulted in the death of 60 million people and the Holocaust. Also, in the case of the Bush Doctrine, what the doctrine says is that when certain conditions arise, when there is a dangerous convergence of, in this case, weapons of mass destruction or the threat of their spread with radicalism, with people who can't be deterred by conventional means, sometimes using force sooner is the lesser moral and geopolitical evil. That doesn't mean all the time. In fact, it doesn't mean it's the norm of American foreign policy. In fact, if you read the Bush Doctrine, and one of the reasons I had it included in the appendix, many people have quoted it, very few people have read it. If you read the doctrine, it's going to be a rare circumstance circumstance where this doctrine is invoked, but I do believe, based on historical circumstances and the current situation we're in, the president was right to include it in our repertoire of options. I also think the president, for all of our problems, was right to apply it to Iraq. In fact, you could make the legal case, not the political one, but technically the Bush Doctrine's preemptive component wasn't applied to Iraq. There was a legal basis for it beyond the Bush Doctrine that you could use technically to justify it. I won't hide behind that. I think that for political purposes, Iraq was a rightful application of this doctrine.
We're talking about the Bush Doctrine and with the author of a book called In Defense of the Bush Doctrine. You can join us by phone. We have open lines right now for you. 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number anywhere you can hear the broadcast. 263-1890 is our Madison number. We'd rather that you use that if you're in Madison. Save us a buck or two. If you prefer to send an email, you can send your comment or question to talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:21. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. For this week, she'll be back next Monday. After 9 o'clock this morning, Kathleen Dunn and her guests discussed the escalating fighting between rival Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, which is looking more and more like civil war. That's after 9 o'clock this morning here on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of a book, In Defense of the Bush Doctrine, and he's a professor of public policy at Pepperdine University, Robert Kaufman, formerly a Bradley Scholar and current adjunct scholar at the Heritage Foundation. And as I mentioned, he's the author of the book, In Defense of the Bush Doctrine. Again, our phone number is, if you'd like to join our discussion, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, call us at 263-1890. We do have some callers who would like to join our discussion, so why don't we welcome first Richard in Neenah. Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Professor Kaufman, I don't want to, I don't necessarily agree, but I don't want to challenge the whole defense.
Oh, you can. Go ahead.
Well, there are plenty of other people who will. what I did want to criticize, though, was you used an analogy with Roosevelt's decision to make Germany a priority during World War II.
Yes.
To me, that's a very weak analogy. First of all, of course, Germany declared war on the United States. The United States did not first declare war on Germany. And secondly, there was a an act of war going on where transatlantic shipping was being sunk by U-boats. That was a very, very different situation than our situation with Iraq.
Well, actually, I don't agree with that. In the case of Germany, Franklin Roosevelt had intended to make Germany the priority and was trying to figure out a way to get into the war, rightly, regardless of whether the Japanese had attacked us first. And one of the reasons is his geopolitical calculation that Germany was a greater threat. Now, as for Saddam, remember that he was in violation of 17 UN resolutions. He had mounted an assassination attempt against an American president. Roosevelt was right, but in many ways, we initiated much of the problem of German U-boats by our aggressive shoot-on-sight policy that Franklin Roosevelt rightly adopted in September of 1941, really even sooner. In some ways, Roosevelt was more provocative with the Germans than President Bush was with the Iraqis, particularly given the UN resolution situation and the historical pedigree. But one of the reasons I don't want to focus on legalisms, and I think I can make a legal case, you've made some reasonable points in rebuttal, is that whether legally or not you could justify this, I think that this is a case where the president argued that waiting was dangerous under this new convergence of circumstances. I think the president is right, and when people focus on the cost of what we've done and I don't minimize it, and I don't minimize the heartbreak. They haven't looked at what the cost would have been had we not done this, and they have not looked at what the alternatives to President Bush, namely negotiation, have yielded with the ripening threat of Iran. For those of you who think that using force is always disqualified until the very last moment, the Iranian situation is going to be a major test of that proposition, because so far at least, the more conciliatory approach of Europe has yielded nothing but brazen Iranian defiance. So that's going to be a controversial issue either for this administration or the next one. But I think that my historical analogy is not perfect, but stronger than the caller suggests.
One of the things you describe in your book is you give a kind of a philosophical label to the Bush Doctrine you call moral democratic realism.
Yes.
Why don't you describe what that is for us?
Well, one of the things I do in the book is lay out alternative views of foreign policy that have underlay the critique of many of President Bush's opponents. Realism emphasizes power and doesn't take into account regime type. Liberal multilateralism takes democratic peace seriously, but thinks that international institutions ought to be the arbiter of international legitimacy. My proposition is a hybrid one that I think was exemplified in the administrations of Truman, Reagan, and this Bush administration. One, it takes the democratic peace argument seriously, but two, it also understands that given the nature of man and international politics, the search for the perfect is the enemy of the good, and that provisional peace, which is always going to be under challenge, is going to depend on the robustness of American power, and that in international politics, what we often are in the situation of doing is choosing not perfection, but the ethic of the lesser evil. So I lay it out much more systematically and in detail than what I can do right now. But that's the essence of this hybrid proposition that I think the Bush Doctrine, the Reagan foreign policy, and President Truman's policy of containment all exemplify to the good.
You also describe the period of time that we're in as a unipolar era. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that the United States in this era of politics is the dominant power, particularly militarily. One indicator is what Paul Kennedy wrote about in the Financial Times. Our military is larger and more powerful in terms of its capability than the next nine militaries combined. The Cold War was a bipolar era with two major powers, the United States and the Soviet Union. The interwar period before World War II was a multipolar era, an era of five or more major powers. And in unipolarity, that is going to give the United States more prerogative, but also more responsibilities to act as a balancer in international politics. So how many powers in the world operate will affect the way in which international politics operates. It won't be the only determinant, but it will be a major one that you have to take into account.
Can the United States sustain the level of military power needed to make this true, though? I mean, if you look at how we're paying for the war currently, it's with borrowed money, a lot of it borrowed from foreign banks who at some point are going to have to call those loans, I would think. But it looks we hear stories every day, comments from people in the military that our armed forces are stretched practically to the breaking point. There is some question about whether if we needed to right now, we could physically mount an attack on Iran that would have any effect on them. Can we sustain the level of military power that we need in order to continue to carry out the policy that you describe?
That's the easiest part of this. The regime transformation and whether we should is the most difficult part. Let's give you some historical context. Right now, we spend a little more than 4% of the GDP on defense. That's less than a third of what we spend on health care. That's what we were spending on the eve of Pearl Harbor. That's less than half of what President Kennedy was spending. Ronald Reagan spent 6.6% of the GDP. 4% of the GDP, by historical indicators, is a relatively easy burden to pay. That's not the issue, and those conditions should persist well into the foreseeable future. The issue is not whether we can but whether we should, whether we need to, or whether there are other alternatives. And my answer to all of those is yes. But of all the problems that we're having with this, bearing the financial burden of the military requirements is the least controversial aspect of this doctrine.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call next from Tom in Stratford. Tom, you're on the air. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Professor Kaufman, I'm willing to listen to your argument, I guess, and I know you're just summarizing it, so we'd have to get the book and read it.
Get the book.
Yeah. In one sense, I can hardly believe that you and other neocons are still getting a platform after what has transpired. I think calling this a doctrine is trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. We had nothing but pretense and hidden agenda and deception from day one. On the whole war effort, and we come up with a military that acts like its commander-in-chief when it fakes heroism with Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch, deception and hidden agenda and pretense. And to use the UN resolutions, how many UN resolutions is Israel in defiance of?
Not a binding UN resolution, none, because we rightly vetoed them.
Okay. That makes them... that makes it okay, huh?
Well, I do think that there's a major difference between a decent and democratic Israel and what Saddam Hussein represented. Now, I will disagree with you, I hope, agreeably on all counts. As for the doctrine itself, I'll give some historical context. President Truman is rightly considered one of the great foreign policy presidents, but at the time, he was a very controversial one. President Truman's approval rating in 1952, the summer before he decided not to run, was 23%, less than President Bush's because of a controversial Korean War that did not, in the long run, invalidate the doctrine, even though applications of it were controversial. So President Bush is in good historical company, given the controversy. I also disagree completely about the issue of deception. Quite the contrary, every intelligence service thought Saddam had these weapons. We found after the first Gulf War that he was closer to having them than we expected. According to the Kay Commission and Dilfer report, this is a portion of it that's largely ignored, but it's salient. Saddam would have had these weapons, and UN sanctions were not only breaking down, but the oil for proof program was a sham. Saddam was using these revenues to buy off the French, the Chinese, and the Russians to obstruct our efforts to prevent him from getting these weapons. In the past, Saddam had displayed a degree of malevolence and recklessness in launching the first Gulf War and using chemical weapons against his own people, brutal and dangerous even by the low standards of the Islamic Middle East. So I believe that President Bush was prudent to eradicate the Iraqi regime. There was no theory of regime change, unlike Iran, where there's a pro-American opposition without using force. And for all the problems, the Iraqis at least have a chance for a regime that's more decent to their people and less dangerous to neighbors. So I see the record and the equities of this conflict, even in our difficulty, in an entirely different way than the caller.
We have an email from Jim in Madison who says, the U.S. is being rebuffed the world over except for a few sycophants. This policy is so prohibitively expensive that it will ruin this nation. Even so, the U.S. military is pitifully bogged down in Iraq. Lastly, while the rest of the world, such as China, India, Brazil, etc., are surging ahead economically, the U.S. will be stuck with this military mentality which will kill this country.
I disagree, again, on all counts. Let's take each of the components of the criticism. One criticism is that President Bush has damaged American prestige abroad, but the record belies that. Our relationship with India, which is going to be one of the most significant achievements of the Bush administration, have never been better. We forged a strategic partnership. Our relationship with Japan is strong. Even in Europe, the most hostile elements of NATO to the Iraq phase of the war on terror, look what's happened in Germany. The German voters have replaced an anti-American chancellor with the pro-American Mrs. Merkel. Even more astoundingly, in France, of all places, where opposition to American power runs deep and viscerally since the time of de Gaulle, France has just elected in this environment the most pro-American president in the history of the French Republic, Mr. Sarkozy. So on all counts, I think that the caller is off base about our standing in the world. And what the caller also doesn't take into account is what would have happened had we adopted a much more passive policy. And let me tell you that one of the things that would have happened with Iraq is what's happening in Iran. The nuclear program is becoming riper by the day. So for all our difficulties, if we had given up this early in the Civil War or World War II, Abraham Lincoln wouldn't have survived 1862. We've applied a standard of criticism to President Bush that none of our greatest commanders-in-chief could have met. So I disagree with the caller, and I think that the best thing to do here for all the problems is to persevere and to keep in mind what we have achieved at relatively low cost given the magnitude of the endeavor and the ferocity of the enemy that we're facing.
Let's go next to a call from Bill in Muscadet. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, Professor Kaufman, thank you, first of all, for writing this book. It's so nice to hear someone actually praising the fact that 50 million people in Afghanistan and in Iraq have been freed.
Thank you. This is the first time, by the way, I was at University of Vermont for 12 years, and I think this is the first time in all my appearances on public radio, and I think it's 20 or something, that I've received a positive call. So if I pause and I'm stunned, that's the reason. But I do appreciate that, and I think that the caller is absolutely right to point out that there's no guarantee in this. But if you look at the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq now versus before, I think people forget how brutal these regimes were, and at least the Islamic Middle East has a chance. And I also want to link this to what's happening today in Gaza for all the people who think that an American pullout is a panacea. An American pullout right now at this crucial stage is going to precipitate a civil war where hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who depended on us will probably die in violence, and that will embolden our enemies and demoralize our friends. I don't want to minimize the losses here. I dedicated my book to a brave Marine who lost his life early in the conflict, but we've lost over 3,000 dead. We lost 4,000 dead pacifying the Philippines, 38,000 dead in Korea, 55,000 dead in Vietnam. In December of 1862, 13,000 Union soldiers under our greatest commander-in-chief, Lincoln, died at Fredericksburg under the hapless Ambrose Burnside. I don't want to minimize our difficulties. I don't want to minimize the mistakes we have made, and we have, but I want to put them in historical context and to make people understand that we've achieved more than you realize, and also war by its very essence, as Clausewitz said, is a process involving friction. And by the standards of war, I think we have criticized President Bush far too severely and underestimated his achievements.
We have open phone lines if you'd care to join our discussion this morning. 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. If you are in Madison, please use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. We're also reachable on the Internet. You can send an email to talk at WPR.org. I'm John Bunsen, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:41. After 1 o'clock this afternoon on Talk of the Nation, join host Neil Conan for questions and answers on vaccines and autism. That's something we talked about here on the Ideas Network yesterday. For years, thousands of families argued that their children's autism was caused by vaccinations. Some parents refused vaccines altogether. Now a special vaccine court is set to decide. Talk of the Nation after 1 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking this hour about the Bush Doctrine with the author of a book in defense of the Bush Doctrine, Professor Robert Kaufman. He's professor of public policy at Pepperdine University. He's a former Bradley Scholar and current adjunct scholar at the Heritage Foundation. He's the author of the book in defense of the Bush Doctrine, and that is our subject this hour. If you'd care to join the discussion, there is a chance for you. Open phone lines at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. You can send an email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones and take a call. This time it's Daniel in Rice Lake. Good morning, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hello. Putin has ordered the shipment of nuclear fuel for Iran's Bashar reactor to proceed. The fueling of the Bashar reactor, I believe, is one of the triggers for the United States air attack against Iran. Should we expect that the logic of the Bush Doctrine and its insistence on preemptive military action will compel the Bush administration to launch an air attack against Iran in order to destroy its nuclear infrastructure?
Professor Kaufman?
I think that the Bush Doctrine rightly applies to Iran, but let me restate what the Bush Doctrine stipulates, that there are cases where where there's a dangerous convergence of weapons of mass destruction and radicalism, the use of force is the lesser evil. That doesn't mean it's the norm. I think the administration was right to identify Iran as part of the axis of evil. I think the administration is right to deem Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons under this regime as unacceptable. Until about 6 months ago, however, I would have drawn a distinction between Iraq and Iran based on the variable of deterrability and the variable that there were alternative ways of achieving regime change without the use of force. The Iranian mullahs, it seemed to me until 6 months ago, were like Stalin rather than Hitler in their propensity to take risk, meaning unlike Hitler, you could deter him or them by a preponderance of American power. Simultaneously, I hope that the combination of robust deterrence and success in Iraq would embolden the large pro-American Iranian opposition that did not exist in Iraq to change the regime and achieve democratic regime change by the same process that regime change occurred in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, especially in Ronald Reagan's final phase. That was my hope. I do think, however, that we are moving into a dangerous phase where we may not have time for that. I'll put the Iranian president's record on the table. President of Iran has said five things that I think we have to take seriously. Holocaust doesn't happen. It should have happened. He wants it to happen. But the destruction of Israel, which is point four, is a mere epiphenomenon, according to the Iranian president, to what the root cause of the struggle is. According to the Iranian president, the root cause of the problem is Anglo-American civilization, which Iran must eradicate by imposing some caliphate based on the lost caliphate of Ali. That's what the Iranian president says. Now, we can dismiss this as mere window dressing. I don't. At some point, and I don't think we've arrived at that point yet, because I'm still hopeful that if we succeed in Iraq, the combination of deterrence and regime change from within can work. At some point, the United States may be faced with the unsavory choice of allowing Iran to have these weapons under the militant mullahs or using military force to take them out. If that becomes the choice, I think that the United States would have to use force as the lesser moral and geopolitical evil. So in answer to the caller's question, if the choice becomes an Iran under the militant mullahs getting these weapons versus using force, I am a proponent under the logic of the Bush Doctrine, which I support, for using force. Again, I hope that we can achieve the necessary goal of regime change by alternative means. Using force is not the norm. But in Iran, I would not rule that out, and in fact would use force if the choice became accepting this president of Iran having nuclear weapons with regional and intercontinental capability with Shahab 2 and 3 missiles, or I would use force as the lesser evil to prevent that geopolitical nightmare from occurring.
Let's go next to Mary in Cudahy. Mary, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to congratulate you for writing this book, and thank you, because it's refreshing to hear an educated assessment and analysis of the war in Iraq, which we really do not get very frequently considering the liberal bias that we hear in the mainstream media.
Well, thank you very much. Look, this is a very emotional issue, and reasonable people can disagree. But one of the reasons I wrote the book when I was doing much public speaking on this, and this is my field anyway, is that I believe that President Bush's doctrine is what Mark Twain said of Wagner. Mark Twain said of Wagner's music, it's much better than it sounds. And I think the Bush Doctrine is much better than it sounds, and that one of the things that this debate had suffered from severely is that people who criticize Bush, even when you don't agree with them, did not take into account that there is really a deep, intelligent, historically grounded case, not an uncontroversial case, but a case for what he's doing. And I appreciate very much, caller, that you appreciate that I am trying to make the case for President Bush in a way that enlivens and deepens the debate and reminds people that what the president is doing has to be taken seriously rather than disparaged as the policy of a raving right-wing cross-burning cowboy or some part of a Zionist conspiracy, which is what the caricature has portrayed this war as. So I appreciate your kind words, caller, more than you know, and I hope this book contributes to taking this debate more seriously rather than caricaturing any side in it.
Let's go next to Mike in Appleton. Mike, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Professor, it's going to be almost three in a row. Congratulations. Thank you for the book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Let me say the following. You know, unfortunately, we live in a different age. You know, it's email, fast talk, instantaneous gratification. And unfortunately, I think people are not going to get it until we get hit again. Or that Iran gets a nuclear bomb and then controls the vast quantities of oil that are in that region, and we end up paying $15 a gallon at the pump. And then, you know, we're going to say, okay, let's go back and get it. And it's simply going to cost more. Hopefully, the Israelis will act before we do and take these guys out. I mean, you know, the sooner the better from my perspective.
Well, I'm sympathetic with your frustration. Let me say, however, on the last point, that Israel was not a plausible option. There are 287 potential Iranian sites, many of which are very hard to get at in forbidding geography, such as the Zagros mountain ranges. If indeed it becomes necessary to contemplate the use of force against the Iranian nuclear program, we're the only country with the capacity really to achieve that result. On the issue of this war being controversial, I try to take a longer historical view. This is fairly typical, and we just have to persevere and stay the course. Now, a lot of people criticize President Bush for his lack of eloquence, and there's a justifiable criticism in that regard. But Abraham Lincoln, our most eloquent president, faced some of the same problems. In 1864, just a few months before the Republican convention, the cost of the Wilderness Campaign in Virginia was so vast, even though we were winning, that Lincoln didn't expect he was going to win, and it looked like a peace candidate, George McClellan, who was going to accept the South's conditions, was going to win. What changed that was the victories in September of 1864 at Mobile and Sherman taking Atlanta. So the idea that we are in a controversial period is really typical, and one of the things that makes America great, despite the frustration, is that we do have a lively basis for discussion and dissent. I am hopeful, it's not a guarantee, that books like this, discussions like this, intersecting with events abroad will convince the American people over the long run that despite all the problems, the Bush Doctrine will survive. I make that claim in my epilogue, where I say that President Bush himself may abandon it or at least qualify it, but it looks like either Mr. Giuliani, Senator McCain, or Governor Romney, if they're elected, will continue the logic of the Bush Doctrine in large respects. So I am hopeful, despite our difficulties, that this doctrine is still alive and well in American political discourse, but I thank you very much for your kind words.
George McClellan didn't lose everything. He did get a saddle named after him.
He did, and I'd be happy to give Mrs. Clinton the saddle if that's the trade.
Okay. Here's another call from Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. Yeah, I just had to make some comments about attitudes of people going back to how people in Europe feel about us. I travel there yearly and have a couple times last year, and I stay with a family that I know. And I can tell you, since this war began and since before the war began, the attitudes of the people have changed a lot. As a matter of fact, the last time I went was the end of last year, and my buddy told me, don't bring up anything. Try not to, you know, bring up anything. And this is in the Netherlands, a place that, you know, just loves us. So how our relationship with foreign leaders really doesn't matter. We can pay them to feel any way we want. It's because it's the people that become the terrorists. And it's the people that will act. And this war on terror simply, I won't say bumper sticker, but I'll say, remember, we still have a war on drugs that's going on. Ronald Reagan's big political stepping stone, you know, that hasn't been won and will not be won. So to think that we're going to be able to squash out people in their basements somewhere in another land is really short-sighted. Just as short-sighted as, you know, the neocons, the ideologues that invaded Iraq, expecting that we'd be loved there. I cannot see how the doctrine has helped at all. We really destroyed our reputation, and it's made it more dangerous.
I disagree, and I'm happy you brought up the Netherlands, because I think it proves the opposite point. Europe in general, and the Netherlands in particular, now has a large internal problem with radical Islam. The murder of Pim Fortuyn is an example of that, and in fact, Europe has a greater stake in our success in Iraq than even we do, given the demographics of Europe, where the native population is declining significantly, and the only surging aspect of the population is the Islamic component. Right now, in Europe, Islamic immigrants have two choices, either to reject their tradition or to reject the democratic societies that they're in. The creation of a stable democratic Iraq and the reconciliation of Islam with the open society will do more in Europe than it will in the United States to ensure that the democratic experiment that the United States, remember, imposed by force after World War II, continues to provide Europe with its greatest era of freedom and prosperity. If you look at what's happened in France and other places in Europe, I see Sarkozy as an example, the fundamentals moving in our direction. There's a growing recognition that it is absolutely essential to address the real root cause of the radicalism that is infinitely more dangerous now that it's converged with weapons of mass destruction, and that is to say the culture of tyranny and oppression in the Middle East that spawns such radical regimes, secular or religious. So I think that the Europeans, above all, have a greater stake in our success even than we do, and I think that slowly but surely France and the Netherlands are examples. Europe is beginning, whether they admit it or not, to acknowledge that our endeavors in Iraq have a vital link to their own freedom and security. So I'm much more optimistic about Europe than the caller is.
Let's take a call from Larry in Madison. Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a comment and then a question. I'm going back to the guest's statement that the United States has not lost prestige around the globe. I'm looking at data from the Pew Global Attitudes Project released in December of 2006. It looks at results of polling toward the results of polling of attitudes toward the United States in several countries, and it finds that across the countries looked at, there was a change of a minus 14%, meaning 14% of the people over that period changed their attitudes from positive to negative. And the guest said that attitudes toward the United States and Japan in particular have improved. Well, this poll was released late December, and it shows a drop of 14%. Also, he mentioned France, but this shows a decrease over that period, continuing to decrease in positive attitude as of December of 06 of 23%. So my question is, from where did the guest get his information regarding world attitudes toward the United States?
We've got just about a minute left, so we'll have to make it quick.
I'm familiar with the Pew Foundation polls, but I don't think that's a valid measure of American prestige, asking questions, what do you think of the United States? Look at the record. Chirac was anti-American and staked his political future on that. Sarkozy is pro-American and wins. If you look at the actions of Japan since the Bush administration, we forged a much deeper relationship. And one of the countries that the Pew Foundation poll doesn't look at as systematically is India, which is the most significant relationship that we forged in the Bush administration. And there, President Bush's approval rating is quite high. If you're measuring prestige, it's not what polling data suggests on a given day. It's how governments act. And I think there's a very good case that in most major countries where geopolitically they're most significant, support for the United States among leadership and actions is much stronger now and would have been much weaker had we proved impotent and inept in dealing with the threat and let Saddam Hussein stand.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Professor Kaufman.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.